Hello. No sign of Mick.
Not yet. Vipin, you're actually the first person I've heard talk on the line. Hello.
Hi. He said that the meeting was happening, so. I think I'm going to say something in rocket chat. Oh, he says, previous meeting is running long. Be on a call in a couple of minutes. So in the meantime, is there stuff we could talk about? I guess not.
I feel like I've been a little bit out of the loop on some of these community calls. I've had so many conferences and meeting conflicts. So I kind of am looking to you guys to say, you know, where everything's at.
Clive? Stan is the quiet one anyway. I get the feeling he's a spy. There he is. Mick is coming on.
Let's see. Do I have it? Sorry. I was trying to make sure I had everything unmuted. Sorry. Deep breath.
Friday.
You know, I might as well move to the East Coast given all of the days these now that start on East Coast time. Sorry. All right. Breathe. All right, who do we have on?
Hi, Emmanuel from Oracle here.
Please add yourself to the notes for today. If you haven't already, Vipin, did you send around the Slack for it?
I have it on Rocket Chat.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow.
Meeting notes. Oh, this is now.
All right.
I don't even know which meeting notes these are.
I got it. Hang on one second. I'll post it into the groups. I can post it. Did you post it to Rocket Chat or I'll get it in here?
I posted a meeting notes. And.
Okay, so I got that in there. And let me pull up the document, the paper as well. Do we have Hart's out this morning, right?
He's not on the call.
I think he's traveling. So And Dan, which Dan is that? Is that Dan Middleton?
Yeah, but I'm just lurking. I haven't been on this call before.
Oh, that's okay. So there are a couple of things that have been going on. We were unable to meet last week in order to work on the paper. So I think the principal issue right now is we need to make some progress on making some commitment to some of the characteristics of the usages that we've been discussing on the VIPN's use case, and then make it as concrete as possible. We are not going to be able to address all possible forms of the ideal model. I mean, I think we just need to come back with something that's appropriate for where we need to get to. And that's something we have to lock down as quickly as possible. So,
I'm not able to find the document itself.
So I just posted the two links in the Zoom chat. Let me post the document link in the Rocket chat as well. For you. All right.
Okay, here it is.
Okay, so we've had a number of questions about sort of what is it that we need to protect? At what level do we need to protect? And I know one of the things we had in the last full meeting that we had at the beginning of May was, for example, discussions about, and I'll call them side channels because they're sort of the out of band pieces, but the information that can flow through the side channels and expose details about what's happening in a particular set of transactions. So we started with Hart's initial proposal for the ideal model looked a lot like, you know, kind of the like a blockchain as a bulletin board. Somebody posts something and that's really being sent to this kind of what we call the trusted third party. A trusted third party then broadcasts information out, and only those to whom the information is targeted or the message is targeted can actually decrypt the message. So we're able to obfuscate sort of point-to-point communication through this one-to-many kind of communication modality. That does make things a little bit challenging on the performance side, it also exposes a little bit of information about who's initiating this set of actions. And so that modality creates a inconvenient side channel where it's the one who has the is holding the debt and is dealing with the transportation issues.
Supplier,
thank you. Jeez. Like I said, my brain is still on three calls ago already this morning. So the supplier initiates the auction, and the response to that auction from the factors, or the response to the request for bids from the factors, then creates a correlation that potentially creates a side channel for kind of a social group or an interaction group. I was at one of the things that came out at the IC3 retreat that I thought was really fascinating and relevant to this, and I'll see if I can dig up the paper for it. Sarah Micheljohn, who's at UCL, did a study on Zcash. So, you know, we all love zero knowledge proofs. They're perfect in preserving anonymity, blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out that with relatively straightforward techniques, you can reduce 70% of the anonymity in any transaction, which means, you know, if you take the entire pool of people who are participating, you've basically cut it down to about 30% of that pool for any given transaction. And it turns out that the reason for that is because The idea behind Zcash is, you know, you put some assets into what amounts to a mixer, and then at some point later, you pull something out which is uncorrelated to the thing that you put in. So you put $100 into the mixer, and at some point later, you pull $13.75 out, and it's very hard to create any kind of correlation between those two transactions. But it turns out that the vast majority of the transactions in Zcash are putting $75.45 in and then immediately turning around and taking $75.45 out. And so even though the zero knowledge proofs provide this wonderful characteristic of disconnecting actions, it's relatively straightforward to figure out who's doing what, because people are not aware of the correlation that they're, that the side channels that their actions create.
That's interesting. Is there a write-up on this somewhere?
Yeah, Sarah Mick, it's work from Sarah Micklejohn. Let me dig this up.
Micklejohn or Micklejohn?
Micklejohn. It was up here once. An empirical analysis of an anonymity in Zcash. It's on archive. Let me post the link in the doc as soon as it comes up. So I'm putting this in the meeting notes.
Yeah, I'm just fiddling around with it. The meeting notes, I mean.
All right. Okay. That should be normal for me. Oh, well. I don't know why it's showing up big. Anyway, we can fix that later. So she did this really interesting kind of analysis of the problems that are related to correlation-based side channels on this. So again, kind of going back to the initial proposal we had for the ideal model was this kind of bulletin board and the trusted third party gives us a way of, by the way, you should be able to just add yourself directly, Vipin. Are you showing up as, okay, never mind. Don't use suggesting mode, just edit mode for this stuff, right? Just add it in. So
I can't get to anything more. It's very strange.
Yeah.
I had that problem before. Anyway.
So this question becomes, and I think this goes back to you, Vipin, and Stan, and some of the others who are kind of representing the actual characteristics of the actual requirements for the users in this case, is many of these side channels can be plugged. They are going to require both technical solutions and sort of institutional process solutions. How do you prioritize and how do you characterize some of the side channel requirements that you have? And I know one of the things we talked about last time was with the private data objects work that we're doing. We're encrypting all of the information that flows back and forth. If an operation fails, it has a very different signature on the amount of data that's moving across the pipe. Even though you can't see the data, you can see how much is, an adversary could see how much is moving and know that a particular operation was a failed operation. And so we've been debating whether or not to do obfuscation by packing additional data into the response to remove even that side channel. And that's the level of discussion we've been having. We, as technologists, are struggling with how to make the trade-offs between performance and privacy in that kind of situation. And so what we're looking for is, you know, and this partly goes back to the ideal model, but without heart here, I'm not going to, this is not what I do for a living. If somebody else knows the ideal model pieces of it, please let us know. But when heart gets back, we can continue the discussion to map it back into that. But from my side, can you talk a little bit about when you think about the different kind of side channels that are potential there, what is it that you want to protect, and how do you make the decisions between the privacy requirements and the performance impact, performance and process impact, and the complexities that arise out of that when you're making decisions about the technology? So when you're evaluating, and you know, I know Stan was talking a little bit about this last time, when you're evaluating the new privacy functions in, I got to be a little bit careful. I'm ducking Dan. The new privacy functions that are in Fabric. I mean, you're doing the evaluation of that. What are the characteristics that you're using? What are the questions that you're asking when you're doing that evaluation in the context of this particular usage?
Is that Stan who has to respond to this?
Is Stan on today? Oh, yeah, yeah. Stan is on today. So he's, you know, I'm going to put him squarely in the crosshairs on this one. So. Sure.
So particularly with the Fabric for the their private data model, right? The overall, the idea that you will only send the payload, even unencrypted, to the party that needs to have access to it. It's very appealing. Then there's something that Todd brought up, right, that they don't hide the keys. So then the concern that, I guess, what the question is, what you're kind of asking now, like, what are the criteria? Like, how do we determine mm-hmm. that this is unacceptable?
And right.
I think the key decision here is, even with replicated data, then you bring up the traffic analysis for the correlation with public data.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of a really non-technical concerns around this. Right.
What do you mean by that?
So some of it are just the, you know, rules and regulations. We cannot be exposing any information to the party who shouldn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
There are legal implications, regulatory, etc. Then there is a kind of a expectation of the self-interest that the party that does receive the data, it is in their best interest to not disclose it to anyone and protect it as best they can. And we're kind of, in a way, their agent.
Okay, so
we try to match their desire for privacy as someone, as the party in the middle.
So in that case, the party protects the data because it's in their best interest to do it.
Right.
And when you're, when you're doing this kind of analysis, how often, I mean, how do you determine what's in their best interest? Are you assuming kind of rational actors? How do you make that determination?
Well, we typically err on the side of paranoia.
Good.
So basically nothing should be ever revealed unless it is explicitly public data. And okay. We should also hide, to the best of our ability, any information that can be used to correlate to this public data. So even when we generate this public information, it needs to be stripped of as much correlatable attributes as possible.
Okay.
do you
and how do any, you how, sorry go ahead Vipin.
Any techniques of like differential privacy or anything like that to achieve that, or is it, I mean, I know that differential privacy is probably more related to aggregations, but you know, any other techniques, or is it, look, the point about what Mick is asking is very simple, right? You always have to balance cost or practical solution, mm-hmm. what is possible in a practical solution with the needs, right? I mean, it's desirable to do something. Okay, fine, well and fine and good. But if regulation says you have to do it, then you don't have a choice, right? I mean, no matter what the cost, obviously your choice would be to go for a system where implementation of such things do not cost a huge amount in terms of data, in terms of development, in terms of operating the system. But so there are two things which Stan brought up here. One is the regulation, the other is the error on the side of paranoia. If it is easy to be paranoid, then you could be paranoid all the time. But if it paranoia costs, you know, like you can't, you know, let's say you're completely paranoid, you can't go out of your house, then you're practically paralyzed. If you don't do anything, then, you know, you won't expose any information. But so there has to be a balance in that area between both courses, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, I guess Mick is asking us to provide a view on that. Like, is there a cost-benefit analysis being done there for that particular piece? The other piece, regulatory piece, we cannot compromise on, right? I mean, so it doesn't matter how much it costs. We probably have to at least try to do it unless they shut us down. Is that...
The solutions usually, again, through the like a standard channels, we try to stick to the paranoid mode. But if there is additional information that's right where you get too concerned about this, as you said, the practical concerns that okay, the data stops being useful. There are usually additional like side channels that are being built. And sometimes they're built as just another side channel sometimes, again, that decision based should make some practical concerns. We just add it to the existing communication.
So maybe this is the other part of my question, which is, you know, is there a process you use? And I kind of wish Todd was here because he felt very, very strongly about this when we talked about it last time. Is there a process you use to identify side channels? Removing side channels is nearly impossible, right? Removing some flow of information out of any network-based interaction is really, really hard, unless you're willing to like spend lots and lots of money on pairwise network connections. And we talked a little bit about that a couple of times. If you can share it, what is the process you go through to identify these correlatable attributes, to identify the potential for side channels that expose additional information? And again, going back to my other sort of higher level question, and then how do you establish the sort of trade-offs between risk and performance in that case? But really, how do you decide what constitutes a side channel in your evaluation?
Well, I guess the side channel, what I'm calling a side channel in this context, is just like peer-to-peer communication with the with the other party. Right?
Okay, so there's an explicit communication channel, which is still out of band, but it's explicit, right?
Right. And obviously, we expect that to be attacked. So there's other transport stuff, security. But as far as the first part of the analysis you were saying, basically, we're just looking at the attributes and see if they are part of the public data. Well, then they provide correlation to that, obviously. Then we do our best to remove completely from the communication any of the attributes that the other side already has. Right, so we try to keep the attributes of the counterparty as private as possible. So we're not avoid putting them in a repeated communication to kind of reinforce the correlation.
Okay.
A practical example of that would be like, let's say that you're interacting with an entity whose legal entity identifier is X, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they have, let's say, an address and a business name and all that. So you wouldn't obviously unnecessarily cite all of those other things. You would probably just stick to some kind of an identifier in the transaction.
Right, exactly. And just avoid every attribute that could be used for correlation that is not necessary to actually allow the intended party to make the correlation. We're just trying to exclude those. Well, because
it feels
pretty straightforward.
What's that?
Can you repeat that?
I guess the logic that goes into it feels to me at least really straightforward and like the logical steps you would take to avoid providing the data that increases the correlation between private and public data.
Okay, so when Todd was talking about some of the new parts of the fabric architecture, he was saying that values are encrypted, but fields are not, for example. So there's clearly some potential for looking, for example, in a change set at the activity on a certain set of fields and deriving information from that. How does that fit into the models that you have? Clearly encrypting values is better than not encrypting values. Okay, so that's not, but I'm trying to figure out where on the spectrum do we go to put the point where we've become too paranoid, and as a result, we're having a substantial effect on performance.
Right. So again, in our case, the keys themselves, the set of keys, mm-hmm. can provide a fairly strong correlation to the type of transaction. So whether it's a trade, and sometimes if it's a trade, even it can point to a specific type of the market. Even if you hide the value, just a set of keys, but when based on some predefined standards, will reveal which kind of a segment of the data you're dealing with. I don't know. Is that clear?
Yep, I got it. So it's not just so that the things that you're modifying become reflective of a particular kind of transaction and activity, and so there might be okay. Again, I'm going to talk like a tech guy rather than a business guy. So please excuse me, but one set of modifications might indicate that you're suddenly looking at a particular futures industry for a particular asset, and another set of modifications might be that there's some interesting trades happening relative to you know, suppliers selling or auctioning off debt to a factor.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. And that information then can be used to identify active markets, and that creates an opportunity for someone to take advantage of it.
I mean, because in a way, you may know who are going to be the more active participants of that market, and then you can try to go with further correlation.
Okay. Got it. Okay, that's good.
But these are acceptable risks, is what you're saying.
Well, I guess there are known risks which we're trying to minimize, obviously. And which is why, again, here we're kind of putting Fabric's privacy model on the spot, right? The fact that they chose to not hide the keys kind of introduces, does not solve the problem of this, at least partial correlation.
Right.
But what about their new solution, the ID mix or whatever, which is obviously not in production yet, but will that have an effect on this, or?
Well, not really, because you still have the ability to correlate it. You're going to be able to narrow down which, the subset of transactions to a specific market. I'm trying to kind of keep it generic, not to talk in finance and exchange terms, but you see where I'm saying? There is still the fact that the identities and identifiers are, let's call it perfectly private, still does not truly help, because there are other attributes that could be used to identify the big players.
Well, it seems like
based on public information.
Well, it seems like even even people who are totally focused on privacy, like Zcash, we're not able to. Basically, my contention is the side channels, which we are not even thinking of, may be brought to the surface by research and investigation, like Sarah's paper demonstrates. Obviously,
yeah.
This whole point being that, I mean, we can only be vigilant, but in the end, there are things that people haven't thought about, which, because either the size of the market, because either the known parties, probably like five of the biggest banks in the world, in a particular market may dominate up to 90% of the market, So by observing that market, you may be able to quickly whittle down the number of participants to, So I don't know. Right. The whole point is, what are we going to achieve in this paper? So in the end, that is the key, right? I mean, because we know that from observation that these things have happened. So maybe there's that section that you're focusing on, Mick, which is, how do you determine enough is enough? Or how do you determine, is there a cost-benefit analysis being done? And if so, what are the methods of cost-benefit analysis? We can only suggest these things. We cannot say, if you do this, you will be eternally safe. I mean, there is no such thing.
And in particular, are there... I would expect that analysis to be usage specific. However, it would be nice to be able to identify general principles or common principles that at least provide a starting point and a means for having that discussion. I say that because, and we've talked about the private data objects work that we're doing and that stuff that's in the Hyperledger labs. And at some point we'll do a demo. I know we're signed up for a session in Amsterdam. So for those of you who would be there, Bruno is going to do a kind of overview demo and tutorial for how to do the private contracts with SGX. So when we're doing the evaluation, we are becoming more and more paranoid about kind of confidentiality leaks, and it has a pretty substantial impact on performance in a number of cases. So circling back then, what kinds of things in these situations, what kind of things are sort of usage specific, and what kind of questions that we ask are kind of generic and generic approaches to this problem that are sort of reusable? And I know, Nathan, I know you're lurking back there and that you've thought about a bunch of these things. Do you have anything that you can add on this? You knew I wasn't going to let you get away with a whole meeting being quiet, right? Okay.
Well, this gets back to Stan's point of if you can make the side channels or the private channels explicit, the idea is to avoid correlation in anywhere that's going to remain immutable. And maintaining that separation is really the shell game going on, right? Because you're not creating or destroying the privacy. You're just moving it around to places where the trust, the system's trust properties allow for the private data to exist. And this is essentially the discussion we had around the blinding values versus blinding attributes is metadata is data too. And if we can make it so that the immutable part of the system is only being used as an anchor or as a proof of existence, we can push the private data or the sensitive parts of the data to another place in the system and then just leverage the proof of existence for what we need. But I think we're always going to go around and round in circles on this in terms of how private transaction sets are structured, because if the ledger itself has to know about the semantics of the transaction, you have to reveal something.
Right.
So the use of this word side channel creates a problem because it means something.
It has many meanings, yes.
Yeah. So I would prefer, I don't know, whatever. There is a ongoing effort. I think it's called L2 protocols, level 2 protocols, which is basically like Lightning Network or something else, where you basically use the blockchain as an anchor, and then there are many things you can gain by taking those transactions out of the system into some other, let's say level 2 channels.
The thing that's frustrating about that way of talking about the conversation is if you're starting from a public channel and then just trying to stuff things out into the private corners of the system, you never really end up addressing the entirety of the problem, because you always end up with some information leakage or correlation from, either how you prove the ordering of the transactions or what you're doing for proof of existence in the public channel. And this is where the philosophy that Stan usually advocates for is, if you can start from the opposite direction, you can say, here's how these two entities would transact in a completely private way. What public proof do they need? Well, what's the minimum public proof that they need in order to have the trust guarantees they need? I think that usually serves us better.
So I just added a link to a paper called Solidus, which is from Cornell, Ari Jules' group up there. And Solidus is using a kind of a form of Oblivious RAM. It's very specific right now to kind of certain sets of financial transactions, and the model is a little bit challenging to extend. But it does have some of those notions for trying to hide, providing the ability to do verification in the public chain for transactions that are completely hidden off chain. It's a kind of an interesting approach and technique. I'm not sure how extensible it is beyond a certain set of transactions, but anyway, that's another paper that you might want to take a look at in this space for a different approach to do it. So
coming back to Nathan's point, which is basically the chain is an afterthought. Is that what it boils down to?
What do you mean afterthought? Consider it an afterthought, but...
Well, the expression I heard was that you reverse the process. You say, what can I do to do private transactions? But, you know, in this... And then, you know, you can say, then how much stuff would I put out in the... Well, in this case, not open because we are talking about federated blockchains, but still open enough. You know, reversing that thought process of saying, okay, these are the transactions we have on the chain. Now, how can we prevent the leakage of private information? Rather, starting from the other side, which is exchange privately, completely privately, and then put only the necessary stuff, absolutely necessary, on the blockchain. So that way, you know, that's why I meant what I meant when I said the chain is an afterthought. That's the what I heard Nathan say about Stan's presentation on this topic.
So, and I see different approaches to this in a bunch of the sort of more emerging architectures for enterprise chains. And, you know, Fabric has the separation between sort of chain code execution and the endorsement policy and the ordering service. And arguably, although this is not the way they currently do it, really the ordering service could be completely oblivious to anything that's happening in the endorsement side of things. Right now it has some notion of what the change sets are and what it's committing to in those change sets, but even to a degree that could be hashed if necessary. I know that the notary service, for example, in Corda, again, is unaware of the transactions. It's really just a hash recording. It really is just a timestamping service for a digital hash. Guard Time has been doing that for quite a while. And in the private data objects, our expectations for the ledger is really just a commitment of a hash on the output of a transaction with a set of dependencies between it in order to give some forced ordering on it. And those architectures, you could argue Lightning, T-Chan, and some of the other side channel ones to a lesser degree, because within the scope of that network, everything is still visible, right?
Well, like Nathan,
there are a number in Ethereum that are trying to do similar kinds of things where the transaction happens off chain.
Yeah, but like Nathan says, they have to go through all kinds of hoops, right? Jump through all kinds of hoops in order to to take the transaction off chain. Second, to impose order on that off-chain transactions and all kinds of other stuff. As you know, this is basically, there's a protocol, challenge protocol, right, in Lightning. Like if the order is wrongly published by one of the participants, then you can challenge it, and then that can result in loss of the complete stake or whatever you want to call it to the other party. So when you execute all those things, that leaks information too, right? That's what
Nathan, yeah, exactly,
I guess.
I think we should draw the distinction between the transactions that are talking about moving chain native assets versus transactions that are naturally kind of off chain, and we're just leveraging the blockchain for the recording, proofing, and security, secure data exchange purposes.
Well, and this is where the ledger is really just acting as like a double spend proof lock, or, you know, kind exactly. of a mutexing system. And the more you can make it unaware of what it is that it's locking, the more privacy you can, you know, allegedly create. But you still end up with the correlation of the locks.
That's a really good point, Nathan. So, and we were making an attempt to try to capture some of those specific semantics in there. Is there value? And again, I'll go back to the GSL from Digital Asset was another one of those attempts to sort of specify some level of commitment semantics for the ledger. Are you aware of others that are doing something more than again, guard time is really nothing more than a time stamping for a hash, which feels too small. Are you aware of others that are trying to bridge that that role as a commitment log?
Well, Indy does. I mean, Sovereign does it, right?
Inside Sovereign, we have a couple projects that are working on this. I'm trying to think of who else has or who else talks about it in those terms. There's a bunch of people who are working on kind of the boiling down proof of before and proof of after part, but I don't think that they're thinking of it as the ledger itself becoming a kind of a global mutex registry.
But isn't a lot of the expressive power of smart contracts and so on disappear with this if the ledger becomes just a mutex registry?
I would argue that depends entirely on well, my question would be, what is it that you're trying to accomplish with your contract? And if your contract has a broad scope, the question would be, does this mutex registry allow you to express that broad scope? For many of the transactions we've been talking about in this particular working group, where privacy and confidentiality matter, one of the things that's sort of a consistent theme that you hear is there are a few parties in the transaction that need to know the details. None of them trust each other enough. And so they have to have a commitment so that if they get challenged on the details, they can go back and prove the existence. And so the community aspect of the ledger is really there to prove existence. And as Nathan said, to enforce double spend, removing of whatever general form that is, right? You know, this global mutex registry. I like that concept, by the way. I need to think more about that. But at least for the things that are in here, what do you see the value of contracts, extending the scope of the contracts into the sort of global nature, Vipin?
Well, I mean, The dream, right, or the promise, rather, is that you would get rid of sort of enclaves of separate enclaves of development in each of these organizations, so that you would come up with some common, business process approach through smart contracts. What you're saying is that it's still possible, even if it were just a global mutex, basically global synchronization log is nothing but a global mutex registry, right?
Yeah.
So there, I mean, that promise where the contracts are coexistent with the data, which we have seen yields tremendous results, can still be exercised if those patterns are well established. That means, like, you know, how do you do those private transactions apart from the ledger and then deposit the proofs back into the ledger or whatever? And the smart contracts are then operating not just in the ledger space, but in the wallet space, so to say, you know, in the other part. So this is, you know, in terms of privacy, I would say that, you know, it's a spectrum, right? I mean, why do you want, you know, not every transaction needs to be private. So you got to be able to pick and choose, I guess. I don't know. I mean, Stan, what do you think of that? I mean, you think that all businesses, all transactions, or do you apply that criteria? Like, is it public now so that we don't have to hide it?
Well, I don't think that is really I don't think that should be the primary criteria. Again, it's the right use for the right use case. If for most of the enterprise business use cases, we're talking about more private blockchain. So the actual use case for the transactions, what is the actual semantics of the transaction? What is it meant? What is on the business level? What is it meant to do? It's expected to do something off the chain. If we're talking about cryptocurrencies, the actions are on the chain. So this is where this true value, in my opinion, of the verifiable logic comes in. If we're talking about more enterprise focused, it's not as critical and essential to the value of the blockchain. So kind of the point that, I mean, Nathan said with his, I love the way to put it, you start with a private transaction, as you would put it, can make public versus you take a public transaction and see what you can hide and still keep the value. So the transactions that are start off in private, that's the way they're happening today. It's an exchange of something or a commitment of something. What do you need the blockchain for? If you need to verify the transaction followed the established rules and protocols, well, you just need to figure out what is it, the minimum amount of information or maximum amount of information you can put without compromising the security and privacy, right? If you can achieve that with private data objects or zero knowledge proofs, great, which is, again, not always achievable. If you can get the same results by just putting the commitment, like use the kind of a distributed ledger aspect of it for the this global Mutex registry, that is enough to achieve the purpose of the transaction that really is anchored off the chain, then that is sufficient. So having the power of smart contracts as executable code on the ledger, I think that there's, as Vipin yourself said, that there's a spectrum. I think there's still a lot of value in it being the commitment confirmation and partial rules validation, not the entire transaction execution.
Okay, we are just about at time today. Again, I'm gonna make another round of trying to set up some time for face-to-face editing on the doc so we can get something put together. One of the things I wanted to just see is, and I'll check with Brian on this. Would it make sense for us to try to put together some set of thoughts on this that are reasonably coherent and submitted as a abstract for the Zurich or the Switzerland meeting at the end of the year?
I think that very much makes sense. I think it might even be a good idea to have two or three talks in parallel where we take apart some of the trade-offs that we're talking about, if more than a few people on the call are willing to to submit some abstracts related to that.
Okay. I will pull together out of the set of notes that we have here, I'll pull together something and send it in. That also has the nice benefit that it'll force us to have something completely written in time for the for the conference. Forcing functions are really nice for, you know, prioritizing and trimming and, you know, committing. So I will put that together. I will post it, just the abstract, to the Hyperloader or to the Rocket Chat channel, and we'll go from there if everyone's okay with that.
Great.
Good.
Okay. Thanks for the discussion. It was really helpful today. We'll meet again in 2 weeks then. All right.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks all.
Thank you.